Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Or partner.
I have one or two friends who I share my location with, but for the people in my day-to-day life, that's a no for me.
So me and my boyfriend tried it, but when he realized that he was checking his Find My for whatever reason, and he was like, oh, can we talk about this? And I was like, yeah, I don't think I need this added, like, sense of security.
I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. We're getting into how location sharing became a norm, and how to navigate that awkward moment if you want to turn it off.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Later on Wildcard, author Jason Reynolds on caring for his mother through illness.
It is burdensome sometimes. It also feels like I'm praying at the only creator that I've ever actually physically known.
After these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Supreme Court announced yesterday it will hear a lawsuit against President Trump's efforts to restrict birthright citizenship, that people born in the U.S. are U.S. citizens. President Trump wants to limit that to babies who have at least one parent who's a citizen or a legal permanent resident. NPR's Ron Elving reports the Supreme Court has shown deference to the president's policies so far.
Should those babies automatically become citizens, even if their parents aren't? The longstanding answer has been yes. But there has also been a body of opinion opposed to that. We had anti-immigration surges in the mid-1800s and in the 1920s, and Trump's broad-scale assault on immigration has in effect closed the southern border and unleashed aggressive deportation efforts. But this birthright citizenship case, seeking to change the way we have long understood the Constitution, would be his biggest trophy yet.
NPR's Ron Elving. Millions of Americans 65 and older are finalizing their 2026 Medicare enrollment. Macy Byers with Nebraska Public Media reports on the choice between traditional Medicare and privatized options.
Some private insurance companies offer Medicare Advantage plans with low monthly premiums and extra benefits. But analysts say premiums and out-of-pocket costs are expected to tick up nationally next year. Nebraska Hospital Association President Jeremy Nordquist works with seniors navigating those costs.
A lot of Medicare Advantage plans, you may pay less up front, but you are taking a bigger financial risk as you age and move forward.
Nationwide, 62 million people can choose Medicare Advantage. Advantage plans may require prior approval for certain services, something Nordquist says can delay or deny care for seniors. For NPR News, I'm Macy Byers in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The latest attempts by European leaders have failed to convince the Belgian prime minister to allow frozen Russian assets be used to finance Ukraine. The European Commission wants to use the money as leverage for a loan to Kyiv. From Brussels, Terry Schultz has more on the story.
German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen met late Friday with Belgian Prime Minister Bart De Wever in an attempt to convince him to back the EU Commission plan to use frozen Russian funds as collateral for a loan to Kyiv until Moscow pays reparations to Ukraine. But De Wever says other EU governments have not provided solid enough guarantees that they would help Belgium reimburse Moscow if it were able to claim back the frozen funds, which he feels is likely. There are also smaller amounts immobilized in other EU countries, which De Wever says should be included as collateral. But so far, no other government has offered up those sums. The Commission hopes for a deal this month. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News in San Francisco, I'm Dana Cronin. A federal judge in San Francisco is expected to issue a ruling soon after he heard California's legal challenge to the continued federalization of 300 state National Guard members yesterday. After the hearing, State Attorney General Rob Bonta said there are limits on the president's power to deploy troops.
And yet this president believes that if he's able to deploy the National Guard, he can then deploy the National Guard in whatever number, to whatever place, for any amount of time, forevermore, thereafter. And he simply cannot.
In court, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer questioned the federal government's argument that protests in Los Angeles last summer rose to the level of a threat of rebellion, or that local law enforcement couldn't handle them. Bay Area soccer fans gathered at Chase Center in San Francisco yesterday to find out what teams will play each other in the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The U.S. will play in Group D with Paraguay and Australia, and a fourth team that will be determined by playoffs in March. Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara will host five of those games, which could also include teams from Algeria, Austria, Jordan, and Argentina. San Jose native and FIFA World Cup champion Brandi Chastain says holding the World Cup in the Bay Area could have a big local impact.
It will give opportunity. It will show soccer at the highest level. It will allow for one young kid, hopefully if not hundreds of thousands of them, to see themselves in the game.
Levi's Stadium will also host one other game later in the tournament. I'm Dana Cronin, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And support comes, of course, from you, the listener, sustaining member of KQED News. Thank you. This week in the Bay Curious newsletter, a mystery from San Francisco's World's Fair in 1915. Who manufactured the gems that bedazzled the fair's Tower of Jewels? Read that story in our Bay Curious newsletter, kqed.org. 6 minutes after 10 o'clock, Michael State, good morning.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. Do you share your location? Do you do location sharing with anyone in your life, or do you follow anyone's location in your life?
I share my location with my kids because they don't allow me to go anywhere else. Without, they're like, we want to make sure you're safe. They're grown.
I'm not like obsessed about that stuff, but my best friend is. So she'll be like, oh, you're at Bryant Park, so you're at work, so I can't call you right now. She checks to see when she can call me.
I go everywhere, so like I just let people know where I am.
And you don't care.
Yeah.
You're like, whatever.
Because I'm always on the move.
Do the people in your life need to know where you are? From what I heard talking to people in Bryant Park in New York City, I'd say location sharing is quickly becoming a new social norm. One survey from market research polling firm Civic Science found that 41% of Americans share their location with someone they know.
I often hear the joke about location sharing where people say, you know, it feels like I'm checking in on my Sims every day.
But there's a bunch of new social rules, some tricky etiquette, and a whole trove of privacy questions that come with this technology. Are we just trading privacy for convenience? And who really needs to know where you are?
That man does not need your location.
To break it all down, I'm here with Gina Sherilis, New York Times styles reporter and writer of their Third Wheel dating column.
Thanks for having me.
And Tatum Hunter, internet culture reporter at The Washington Post.
Yeah, same.
All right, let's get right into it. Do you share your location or track anyone else?
I have one or two friends who I share my location with almost as a bit where, you know, we turned it on forever ago. We never turned it off and now we'll acknowledge it once every 6 months. For the people where it makes the least sense for them to know where I am, that's when I become okay with it. But for the people in my day-to-day life, that's a no for me.
Gina, what about you? Do you share your location with anyone or do you track anybody else?
I do, both actually. So I share my location with some of my closest homegirls. And I want to say maybe 7 of them have my location.
You mentioned that you share your location with like 7 people, but none of them are your boyfriend. Is there like a specific reason for that?
Well, yes. So me and my boyfriend tried it. I would say maybe several months in, he traveled and we shared locations. And I think at some point he forgot. Mm-hmm. But when he realized that he was checking his Find My for whatever reason and he was like, oh, can we talk about this? He was expressing some hesitancy and I was like, yeah, it's fine. We don't have to share a location. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I need this added like sense of security. And I also wanted him to feel comfortable.
Okay. I don't share with anyone
and no one shares with me. Mm-hmm. I dawdle. I walk around. I do things slowly. I say I'm going to leave and I haven't left yet. I mean, I love my husband. I think he's so wonderful. I don't think he needs to know where I'm at 24/7. I just don't like for people to know where I am.
One of the things I love to do is like go on the app and just see like, oh, I have this friends in Kenya, this friends in Tokyo. There's like two of us still in New York. This one's in LA. And I'm like,
we're everywhere.
Yeah.
You're like, we're so cool. We're
yeah, exactly. Like I think me and the girly pops are just like, yeah, like, okay, I see you or whatever. Yeah, but I can definitely see how it's a point of contention for so many people.
I mean, according to a survey by market research polling firm Civic Science, 41% of Americans share their location with someone they know, with 65% of Gen Zers saying yes. And this might be because they grew up with, you know, casual surveillance being normalized with things like Life 360, which is a location tracking app for families. You know, my parents, they would have loved Life 360. No, they would have used it to track me 24/7. I can see the desire to sort of like know where your kids are and feel that peace of mind. And now their children who are growing up and becoming adults, they're also now used to kind of continuing to track not just like, you know, maybe other family members, but their peers and friends as well.
What I find really fascinating about Gen Z is that similar to you, Brittany, my parents kept a short leash when it came to me and my siblings. And I was that teenager who would push back on a lot of those like strict rules. And when I look at Gen Z, I'm like, they're not pushing back on this location sharing. And like, why is that? Hmm. I feel like if I turned 15 or 16, I would have been like, you guys have to stop, please. I can't be tracked anymore. And I think a big reason for that is I think for their generation specifically, it's very unique, right? They experience record high numbers of mass shootings and school shootings compared to previous generations. I mean, there's like so many things like you can argue as to why this is important and why it's making parents feel better. It's quelling their anxieties and why the kids themselves may be on board with that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a cultural thing where if you grew up with it always on in your family, it's of course going to seem less strange when you kind of expect it from your friends or your romantic partners or even your coworkers. The promise of safety, I'm sure, was so appealing to families, but it's really hard to predict the ripple effects of this stuff. Hmm. That lack of trust, you don't need trust anymore if you have this child's location. It circumvents some of the relationship and intimacy and trust that you would have had to build with that child or teenager before. We no longer have to have conversations about where you're at, what you're doing, and whether you're telling me the truth and why, because the technology has short-circuited the whole conversation. And that might be a good thing for some families, but in others, it might be a corrosive thing, especially as, like you said, that kid brings that expectation and that technological shortcut with them into adulthood with their friends and romantic partners. Are we missing out on anything when we don't have to communicate with each other about where we are, what we're up to, and how transparent we're being about that?
I'm wondering where we see benefits for some users as far as like, you know, friend tracking. Like I've heard of, you know, other reasons why people might like to track their friends to increase FaceTime, to be like, hey, I'm in your neighborhood. Like I want to drop by. Or like there's also something I've heard of, a sense of digital intimacy. What do y'all think about that?
I think that's a big reason for it. I mean, to feel like you have a sense of closeness, and also I think it's a way of like becoming friendship official, if that makes sense. I remember one time a friend of mine who I love dearly, she was like, hey, I don't have your location, let's exchange. But that was the first time that I realized that this was something you could just ask for without it being because I'm traveling or I'm going to be out late. Like I shared it with her, but in my head I was like, oh, this thing has evolved. Mm-hmm.
But I also like the term digital intimacy because it reminds you that just like other forms of intimacy, it comes with some risk, just like physical intimacy, for example. It can be really awkward to say no. I spoke with one young guy for a story on location sharing who he was in his first ever like grown-up job, going out for his first happy hour with a new coworker, And, you know, they're talking, they're drinking beer, and the coworker says, oh, I like having all my friends' locations. I like having everyone's location. Can I have yours?
Whoa.
Coworker?
Yes. And this guy was really taken aback. He didn't know how to decline. Mm. And so he didn't decline. And so I think that it's important to acknowledge that it's like, you're never going to convince people that this isn't super convenient. And in a lot of cases, really fun, especially if you live on a campus or in a city. Like you said, it's so easy to keep tabs on the people you love and meet up with them and know that they're safe. But I think my question for people is always, at what point would it become inappropriate for you? At what point would it become too much?
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, here with Gina Sherilis, New York Times styles reporter and writer of their Third Wheel dating column, and Tatum Hunter, internet culture reporter at The Washington Post. We're discussing the etiquette of location sharing and whether it's convenient or creepy. So we understand kind of like what the emotional sort of reason why many people are interested in location sharing. But I wonder, what's the business rationale from Apple or Life360 or SnapMap to offer these location tracking services?
So a lot of the apps that we use make money from advertising or profiling their users and selling those profiles to advertisers. And people's locations are a really valuable form of data. They tell us a lot about people, where they spend their time, what sort of businesses they visit, how expensive or cheap those businesses are. While companies like Apple aren't just farming location data and then like selling it to the highest bidder, they do have advertising businesses as part of their corporation. Location data is a huge part of Google's advertising business. And so you start to see how getting consumers used to the idea of sharing their real-time location, not only with each other, but then with the apps in their life and the companies that own those apps, is a real boon for tech companies. They have a really valuable peek into people's lives that they can then use to better target ads or to build more valuable and specific profiles of their users.
I don't know. I suppose with location sharing, we're giving everyday individual people power that, you know, giant corporations already have. But I mean, in my personal view, like for me, I'm like, corporations are looking at everybody. Like they don't care about me specifically, but there's meaning when someone that we know personally, they potentially judge or maybe follow too closely our whereabouts and what we're doing.
Yes.
This technology and these location sharing features can be used in situations of abuse.
Right. Married couples have had issues where one spouse will secretly put an AirTag in the other's car. And so Apple had to issue a notice saying, you know, they had to tell people like, hey, guys, this is illegal. Don't use this for that.
Yeah, they put out a press release about that a few years ago. Right.
When it's someone you know very directly and personally, and that person also knows where you live, maybe they know your siblings, maybe they know your friends, having your location on a random Wednesday, they can do more damage with that depending on what it is that they'd like to do.
See, I know that sometimes if someone stops sharing their location with you, our intern, Mika Ellison, she described this as like a social faux pas. Like if it's like a thing or at least like a mini drama to stop location sharing with someone, how do we kind of get out of the location sharing thing?
You got to talk it out. I mean,
but I feel like isn't location sharing, isn't the point of it to avoid talking?
I think, yes, I think that has become the point of it. But I think because of, you know, just to go back to digital intimacy, I think because of the importance we've placed on it, that means it is something you should talk about with the person who you deeply care about if you're choosing not to share it with them, especially if you know that they'll care, they might feel some type of way, or they might be left confused or abandoned by it. It's like, that's not really kind. I think that if it's someone who you randomly, you know, went out with one night and you guys share locations, then okay, it's probably fine to just remove the location sharing. But I would just shoot them a text like, hey, FYI, I'm removing locations because I'm now becoming more concerned about my own personal privacy. And I just want you to know it's not personal.
Smooth. I didn't even think about that.
We definitely need a digital protocol for breakups. People these days break up and you kind of forget that that person had your Apple login. They had, you know, your Instagram open on their phone. You get so enmeshed and then it's hard to even remember all the digital ways you were connected. I dated somebody and then stopped dating them last summer and realized after we stopped seeing each other that I was still sharing my location with them like months and months and months and months later. And of course, this was like a totally nice person. And so it was fine. But I was just like, oh my gosh, this was kind of a big thing for me to just forget.
Okay. So to that end, what is privacy? How do we think about that now?
I think that because different people's preferences for privacy will be so different, a good definition is privacy is the freedom to choose. Privacy is the freedom to choose what you want to share. So many of our conversations about digital privacy, I think, would benefit from being consent-based. I see companies, for example, all the time saying, we protect our users' privacy by doing X, Y, and Z. But the users had no say in any of this. They didn't get to opt out. They didn't even really get to opt in except by using the product or the service. So I think if we were able to move toward an understanding of privacy where everyone really guards closely that ability to say yes or no to each piece of information about themselves that they share, we'd be closer to something healthy. Privacy is the ability to go off the map when you choose.
I gotta say, after this conversation, I think I'm gonna continue to match your location. I'm gonna stay the course. Gina, Tatum, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
That was Gina Sherilis, New York Times styles reporter and writer of their Third Wheel dating column, and Tatum Hunter, internet culture reporter at The Washington Post. And thanks to all the people who talked to us on the streets of New York.
Keisha Washington.
Kyle Munson.
Samuel Farber.
Coming up, is wokeness back? And what does dark woke have to do with it?
I think one of the things that the popularity of dark woke reveals is how much politics right now is about being good at posting.
I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. And Post, Peninsula Open Space Trust. Now, Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org.
This week on the Sam Sanders Show, legendary costume designer Ruth E. Carter. From Malcolm X to Sinners, she built the look of Black Hollywood.
I see, you know, a young Black girl in there pulling for her show. I feel like I've had something to do with that. And I'm welcoming that.
Ruth E. Carter on costuming Sinners, Black Panther, and also Seinfeld.
And the premiere of the Sam Sanders Show here at tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at MadeInCookware.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show where we talk about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. So, what happened to Woke 1.0?
I tend to think that Woke 1.0 was murdered by the pandemic.
I am not convinced we've exited Woke 1.0. I mean, there are still a variety of issues that you basically cannot touch with a 10-foot pole.
Target sales have plummeted after rolling back DEI policies. The Red Scare podcast faced backlash after interviewing Hitler-loving conservative pundit Nick Fuentes. Democratic socialist Zohran Mamdani was elected mayor of New York City. What do all of these have in common? Well, some people online are saying woke 2.0 is the culprit. But is that really the case?
I mean, to me, I'm not so sold on the idea that there's been some death knell of wokeness, at least within these liberal circles.
We're getting into it with Constance Grady, senior correspondent on the culture team at Vox.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Tyler Harper, staff writer at The Atlantic and co-host of the podcast, Time to Say Goodbye.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so just some background. As a term, woke has a long history in Black culture, dating back to the early 20th century. It meant being politically conscious and aware, but to be frank, it was also used a bit tongue-in-cheek. But in this conversation, we're digging into the way woke is used today as political shorthand for the left. So first off, before we get to woke 2.0, how would you describe woke 1.0?
I think we see the idea of wokeness start to mainstream circa roughly 2014 and the Ferguson protests.
Right. It became a rallying cry for the Black Lives Matter movement and digital activism circles.
This is when the idea becomes increasingly mainstream in white liberal circles that systemic racism is an animating force in American culture. And also when it becomes trendy enough for, you know, a corporation to want to post a black square to Instagram after the death of George Floyd, or for Disney to want to include a token queer character in the live action Beauty and the Beast remake, right? These are not gestures that necessarily mean or do anything, but they get coded as woke because there's a sense that there is cultural capital to be had from aligning yourself with this ethos.
I wonder how both of you feel about like the perception of wokeness and how it affects consumer habits. We have some data that says that Target's brand perception has taken a hit since it rolled back its DEI policies. And Starbucks has long been riddled with accusations of union busting and more recently its perceived position on Israel-Gaza. But at the same time, if I think about like the controversy surrounding Sydney Sweeney and the Good Jeans ad for the American Eagle jeans, where it kind of seemed like they were doing a little bit of eugenics, I don't know that American Eagle was thinking about it that high level. I can't say that. I wasn't around for that. To me, it came off as completely sort of like thoughtless. But regardless, conservatives really picked up on the backlash to that ad. And Sydney Sweeney has become something of a conservative idol, a conservative darling. American Eagle stock went up after that ad rant and after the backlash. So I don't know. What do you both make of that?
I think one of the reasons, you know, the Sydney Sweeney thing seemed to actually help the company in question is just because I think people are tired of that kind of approach to politics where we are close reading everyone's statements, every single message that comes before us and trying to insist that there's some dog whistle hidden therein, right? I think especially at a moment when like really noxious elements of the far right and sort of the neo-Nazi right are ascending where, you know, American culture is suffused with like more actual racism than I think I've encountered at any time since I've been alive.
Yeah, I just want to pop in for a second. It sounds like what you're saying is that like the popularity of like nakedly racist and nakedly homophobic, nakedly transphobic, nakedly mm-hmm. anti-Semitic messages is so high mm-hmm. that you think that there may not even be necessity to code it into like this sort of denim ad.
Yeah. And I also just think people have reacted pretty negatively against the, you know, the sort of censoriousness or perceived censoriousness of the left that like everyone's speech is constantly scrutinized for accidental faux pas. And I do worry that there's a real sort of like, you know, boy who cried wolf thing that's been going on for a couple of years now. You know, progressives have called everything under the sun racist for the better part of a decade, if not longer, right? And now we have some real wolves in the hen house, right? Like people like Nick Fuentes or the virulent anti-Semitism of Candace Owens, right? And I think people have been so desensitized to accusations of racism being thrown around all the time.
I don't know. I think that generally, like a lot of Americans' appetite for thinking about racism is so low. I think it's just always very low that I don't even think that a boy who cried wolf situation even really applies or could apply.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is how much of our conversation about wokeism, so-called, or about our political beliefs, we end up having in the language of consumption, of being buyers of products. Of course, voting with your dollar and boycotting is a very time-honored political action, but it's as though we seem to have our voices limited in the ways that we can talk about these things as everyday people. And so we are limited to creating our identities as primarily consumers. We are what we purchase and what we express our values and how we think of ourselves in those ways.
To kind of bring things back to the present, I mean, I feel like post Mom Donnie's win, there's been a wave of memes and online discourse about, you know, woke being back, woke 2.0 hitting harder than woke 1.0. Why do you think Mom Donnie's win, or even Mom Donnie as a political figure, has invigorated a new wave of this feeling for some people?
Yeah, so I think that something Mom Donnie has been able to accomplish very skillfully is show off his ability to court Trump's base of disaffected people who feel that there needs to be some kind of fundamental change in politics and who are really just really worried about their paychecks without appearing to really disrespect either them or his progressive base. I think it's kind of the Democratic dream, someone who will be able to unite an ability to appeal to this sort of economic populist message that excites Trump supporters and also maintain this ability to excite a Democratic base about an identity politics message.
I actually think it's because he's pretty squarely avoided identity politics. I mean, the people, the campaign that was doing identity politics in New York was not Mom Donnie. It was Andrew Cuomo, who was launching attacks about his alleged quote-unquote anti-Semitism.
And Eric Adams. Do not forget that either.
And Erica Adams, yeah. Right? That was, releasing these horrifically racist AI videos, just really grotesque forms of Islamophobia. So I think Mom Donnie pretty studiously avoided getting into any of these debates about identity. He was relentlessly focused on affordability.
Regardless of, you know, how we feel about, well, 1.0, is it alive? Is it dead? Is it like Tupac, where some of us are seeing him and some of us aren't? Like, I still think it's compelling. What does it say, or what does it mean that people, at least some people, are clamoring for that time to return?
Yeah, so to me, what this is talking about is that the problems that the word was created to describe still exist, and people still want a solution to those problems. Over the past 10, 15 years, the right was able to kind of destroy the word, but they haven't really done anything about the problems themselves.
I am certainly no supporter of the right, but, you know, one thing you can say for conservatives and for MAGA, it is very clear. These are our friends. These are our enemies. These are the words we use. These are the words we don't use, et cetera, right? It's kind of the mirror image. And I think one of the reasons, the left has been floundering a bit since wokeness has been in decline is that they don't really have a sweeping cultural vision for the country in the way that they did during the woke years. And until I think they, can put forward once again an image of, like, if you are on the left, if you're a liberal, this is what a good life means, right? This is a good way to live, which they had in 2020. I think they're still going to be out in the sort of cultural wilderness a bit.
I appreciate this conversation with both of you so much. Constance, Tyler, I have learned so much here. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Oh, thank you.
That was senior correspondent for the culture team at Vox, Constance Grady, and Tyler Harper, staff writer at The Atlantic and co-host of the podcast, Time to Say Goodbye. I'm Brittany Luce, and you've been listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. Next up is Wildcard, the show where cards control the conversation. Here's host Rachel Martin.
Thank you, Brittany. My guest this week is author Jason Reynolds.
Rest feels a little bit irresponsible. It feels a little disrespectful to all the people who want to be sitting where I'm sitting. For the people who deserve to have their stories told, but for whatever strange reason won't get their moment.
I want you to think back to when you were a kid. Was there an adult in your life who didn't talk down to you? Someone who instantly just treated you like a person with your own perspectives and life experiences? Jason Reynolds has built his entire career around not talking down to kids. His best-selling and award-winning young adult books include Long Way Down, Ghost, and two Miles Morales Spider-Man novels. All of his stories come out of his own experience as a black kid growing up outside Washington, D.C. Kids are complicated people, and Jason Reynolds treats them that way. Jason won a MacArthur Genius Award in 2024. It is my pleasure to welcome Jason Reynolds to Wildcard.
Thank you for having me.
Are you ready to play our game?
I'm sorry. So you don't know this about me, but I'm such a competitive. I love any kind of game. Oh, any kind of game.
You do?
So I do.
Well,
I do.
Okay, great. Then we're off to the races. I mean, you're sort of like competing. I don't know what you're competing. You're competing with yourself.
That's even better. It's even better. It's even better.
Okay. First three cards. One, two, or three?
Let's go with one.
One.
Yep.
Is there a meal from your childhood that brings back strong memories?
My mom had this thing. I don't know where she got it from, by the way. She had a weird obsession with feeding us turkey wings. And so we would have turkey wings like every night. Turkey wings and like a broccoli every night.
A turkey wing.
Yes.
Like that's a particular choice.
I know.
It's not the turkey leg.
No, no. A wing. My mom would make a whole pan of wings on Sunday and we would eat off that pan for the rest of the week. And so what it brings back memories of is just the simplicity of my life, even in the midst of actually, it's funny because it was complex. It was simple, but it was torrential at the same time. My parents split, you know, you go through that thing that so many of us go through around that age, right? 10. 11 years old. My grandmother dies. I'm experiencing death for the first time. The first of many, many, many to follow. I mean, my teenage years were full of death. I've got family in and out of the house who are living with me, people dealing with different things, you know, and no matter what was, I'm being bullied in my new school. I'm going to a new school and I'm failing school and, you know, all of this kind of stuff.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
But those turkey wings were there every night. Mm-hmm. You don't see it at the time. It's so interesting what you don't see as a child, right? You don't see it at the time, but as an adult, I look back and I'm like, God, they were an anchoring point.
Your mom knew that, though.
My mom.
She knew that.
She definitely knew that.
It was important to put a meal on the table and have people gathered together.
Yep.
And a turkey wing and some broccoli. That's a healthy meal.
Exactly. And shout out to my mom.
I'm going to tell my kids that when they complain about having the same chicken every night. This is your stability.
Exactly.
You don't appreciate it now, but you're going to look back and remember that this is your safety net. That was lovely. Three more cards. One, two, or three?
Two.
Two. How do your parents show up in you?
Oh, God. I like to say that my mother taught me how to think in about the world, and my father taught me how to be in the world. My dad was life of the party. He had such a golden personality, and he was such a sweetheart. He was a progressive, open-minded, open-hearted man at a time when that was a no-no. I mean, a man covered in tattoos in the a black man specifically covered in tattoos in the 1970s. But on the flip side, my dad was also a psychologist. So he was grounded in, like, he would go to work every day. You know, he was very sort of like, this is sort of what life is. We try to understand each other, but also tattoos, motorcycles, fast cars, craziness, right? Rock and roll, rock and roll, rock and roll, rock and roll. Then my mom, this Southern woman who has worked the same job since she was 15 years old. She's the one who is like, you know, I put on my suit every day. I go to work, conservative, right? And then I'd come home from school and there's like, you know, it might as well be my house is like an ashram, because my mother was very much into all things that were sort of, you know, all sort of Eastern spiritual practices and all this other stuff. So she'd go to work in her very fancy, you know, conservative business suit. She worked in insurance, so she didn't have a fancy job, but she would put on her suit,
yeah,
right? And then she would come home and it would be all about like helping me understand the law of Dharma. Right. Mm-hmm. And talking to me about the Bhagavad Gita and asking me if I had any questions about the Eightfold Path and if I wanted to have conversations with her about, you know, like it's about anything that is that in today's time, by the way, is very much en vogue. Right.
Yeah. Like, it's hard to overstate how unusual that was.
It's so unusual.
Did you take any of that with you?
Yes. Not as much these days, but as part of my foundation, the idea of belief, despite my logic and reason, has been really healthy and helpful for me only because I'm smart enough and I have enough critical thinking skills to know that I'm choosing to believe in these things as coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. My ideas around all of this stuff is like, look, life is hard and it helps to believe that there is something more intelligent than I am. It mm-hmm. helps to believe that the universe is some sort of grand mathematical equation far beyond my ideas and my capacity to understand. It helps to have faith in each other, let alone in the natural processes that we live, the natural rhythms mm-hmm. of our lives. Like these things are just, to me, they feel very practical, but also that I'm choosing this as a way to manage the complex life that will never, ever, 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 ever be simplified.
Yeah.
And that's because of my mom.
Coming up, tears come easily to author Jason Reynolds, and he's proud of it.
I am a crybaby of all crybabies. It is my favorite thing about myself.
I'm Rachel Martin, and you're listening to Wildcard from NPR.
Support for KQED comes from Peninsula Lively Arts, presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, a spin on a holiday favorite with beloved music and fresh moves. December 20th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center. Details at peninsulalivelyarts.org. And Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. More of the program ahead, including the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me News quiz. That's ahead at the top of the hour.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Zach Zimmerman marveled at the discovery of the largest spider web ever found.
Did it say some, really, really, that is some pig.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us to hear our commentary on the interesting creatures in the week's news, plus Andy Richter dishing about his recent run on Dancing with the Stars. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Legacy Box, dedicated to preserving family memories, old tapes, films, and photos, with the goal of spreading joy of reliving the moments that matter. More at legacybox.com. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone. At betterhelp.com/public. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
I'm Rachel Martin, and you're listening to Wild Card from NPR, the show where cards control the conversation. And today, author Jason Reynolds is playing the game, and it's time for him to draw the next card. Round two, insights.
Let's
start with two or three.
Let's start with two.
Two. Are you good at being alone?
My favorite thing in the world. Truly, I think that when you work as a writer, you value time to be alone. I need to think and I need to, I mean, I'm a person, I spend a lot of time by myself and I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. And I love being around people too. But that requires a different kind of energy. To refill the well, I need some alone time. I go to the gym in the morning every day and then I come home and I take a bath. Every day I take a bath, like an actual bath. Every day, so sometimes good. Twice, sometimes at night too.
Two a day bathing.
Yeah.
With the bath, with the bubble bath, straight water.
I put everything in there. I'm one of those people. I got all kind of salts and flowers and all kind of, there's something about sitting in that. And I'm a large person. I'm a big guy. So I have a very big stone tub that I sit in. And there's something about being enveloped in a stone cocoon. Mm-hmm. And I just sit there. I just sit there until the water is cold. And I just think, or I just be and breathe, or I imagine and daydream. I think we really underestimate the importance of imagining, of just taking a moment to imagine and to be weird in that imagination.
Yeah.
Everything's a go if it's just inside your brain, right?
Yeah.
I need that. It taps into a part of my youth and my playfulness and my childlikeness and sometimes my childishness, which are not the same things. And because I think when I was a kid and I had lots of friends in the neighborhood, but we still our imaginations were easily accessible. It was much easier for us to go outside, take a walk, or go get candy from the store and pretend the candy made us stronger, or go to, or, you know what I mean? The power pellets. We had, these are our power pellets. So we could, right? The imagination was always right at the sort of, you were always brimming with it. It was right at the lip.
Yeah.
Right? Of your psyche. And now it's not that way. I have to go and tap in. And that requires silence.
Three more cards.
One.
Ooh, you knew right away.
One.
How easily do you cry?
If the ASPCA commercials come on, you're going to, let me say something. The moment I see them dogs and that.
I don't know why I'm laughing. They are very sad.
I can't
yes.
help it. I am a crybaby of all crybabies.
Are you a crier?
It is my favorite thing about myself.
Why?
Because it reminds me that the expectations of masculinity didn't get me. That I avoided it. That somehow, some way, I was able to maintain a sense of freedom. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. And there are moments in which perhaps it puts me in precarious and embarrassing situations. But the people who love me and the people who are around me understand me well enough to know that he's going to need a moment to get this out. And that's it. There's nothing to talk about. I'm fine. I just need a second to shed these tears and to feel what I'm feeling. And then we can move on with the conversation. I have no problem crying publicly in front of audiences of people because I don't mind telling people that I appreciate folks bearing witness to a man who is able to somehow remain free. I'm grateful for it. I really, really, really am. And I'm grateful for my mother and father for my friends that I grew up with who are still my same friends today for allowing me space to be myself without forcing me into a box that I do not belong in. So, yes.
That makes me cry. Yeah. I am also an easy crier. But I love that as the mother of two boys.
Yeah.
I love it. And I want to lift that up, and it's hard. It's hard to be a boy.
Oh, my God. Tell me about it. But this is the reason why I am grateful to have writing. Mm-hmm. I can put it somewhere, right? And that's what it did for me when I was 10. That's the reason I started writing in the first place. It's because my mom was crying. I was okay. I mean, I was going through what I was going through with my dad, but it was my mom who was hurting, and I was trying to figure out how to make her feel better. And that's the reason I started to write poems for her, to try to figure out how to help her. Right. Mm. So I think as long as, you know, it's important for people like us to just make sure we have a canister for this. We have to put it somewhere. And then, you know, we'll be able to manage our health differently.
Yeah. We're at the last round. It is about beliefs. Here we go. One, two, or three.
Let's go with three.
How do you think your life should be judged?
By my efforts. Are you trying? It's easy to say you are, right? Mm-hmm. Are you trying? It's even easy to stumble into success one time,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a possibility mm-hmm. that you could, like, it happens all the time. But do you have the effort? Do you have the stomach to be effortful for the long haul? That he lived an effortful life in every part of his life and everything that he chose to pour himself into. That's it.
Oh, but my dear, I hear in that when you're trying so hard, when everything is like, when you view your life as being judged by your effort, then you're going to keep going.
I know.
You're going to keep efforting, and that is exhausting.
This is the problem. I mean, look, my dear friend and everybody's favorite human, LeVar Burton, told me one day, he was chastising me, scolding me about this very thing. And he said, I know, I love you because I know you well enough to see myself in you. And he said, when I was your age, I was in the same place and I didn't learn to rest until I was 50. And he mm-hmm. said, that meant for 35 years of my life, I was living like somebody was chasing me. Mm-hmm. That's no way to live. Right now, I know this mm-hmm. to be true. But for some yeah. of us, it's just a really hard thing to turn. It's almost pathological. Yeah. It's a really strange thing to turn off. I mean, I come from a person.
Does it feel selfish?
To turn it off?
Yeah.
It feels.
And rest.
It feels irresponsible.
Mm.
And it shouldn't, right? If I have I have an unhealthy relationship with rest, right? But because to me, there's not a moment in my life where I'm not aware of the privilege and of the gift of a life that I have been afforded. I also know that there are many people who are more talented and who has worked harder than I have and who could turn a phrase sharper than anybody in the world, who may never get their opportunity to live the life that I live. And so for me, my job is to justify every day why it's been given to me. My job is to honor them by doing my very best to make the most of the fact that it happened to me. So rest feels a little bit irresponsible. It feels a little disrespectful to all the people who want to be sitting where I'm sitting, for the people who deserve to have their stories told, but for whatever strange reason won't get their moment. If this is my lot in life, then part of me just wants to kind of shoulder that, knowing what their lot in life might be.
Yeah, I hear you.
If you're just tuning in, this is Wild Card from NPR, the show where cards control the conversation. I'm Rachel Martin, and my guest today is author Jason Reynolds. It's time for Jason to pick the next card. Last one, Jason. One, two, or three.
Let's end with number one.
Is there anything in your life that feels like praying?
What a great question. You know, my, yes is the answer. My mother is 79, almost 80. And she's dealing with some health challenges. And these health challenges over the course of the last year has put me in position to be a caretaker. And part of that caretaking means that my mother, I have to take care of very intimate things as it pertains to my mother. I have to wash her and I have to clean her. I have to, I pull her panties up and do all sorts of things that, to be honest with you, I did some of this stuff when I was 18, when she was ill with cancer a long, long time ago. So it isn't that it's jarring. It's that at this age, it feels different. And at this age, it feels in the midst of its burden. Cause it is that, if we're being honest, it is burdensome sometimes.
Yep.
It also feels, like prayer. It feels like I'm praying at the only creator that I've ever actually physically known. Right.
Your mom.
My mother. I'm bowing at the feet. I'm washing the feet of the only God I've ever physically touched. And, does it feel like praying? It feels like praying and everything else. This is the hallelujah of all hallelujahs. And I really, really mean that. It doesn't mean it's not difficult. It's painfully difficult. But I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you that difficulty is only a piece of this experience, right? I went through this with my dad. As my dad was dying, we went through a similar experience. I felt the same way. It's me acknowledging a vessel that has given me everything that I've become. And as that vessel continues to sort of to empty, right? It's seeping out. And she's not on E yet and she's fine, but E is coming. The tank is emptying, right? And to be there, and to maintain this vessel, to maintain her comfort, to maintain her dignity by making sure that she's clean and cared for. Come on. I mean, what else could prayer be? Prayer can't just be asking, right? Sometimes it's me saying, I'm so grateful for everything you've given me, that me taking these 45 minutes to bathe you is a very small drop in the bucket of the gratitude that I actually owe you. And I will do everything I can to refill, to pour into this until I can't pour, or you don't have a bucket anymore for me to pour into. What a gift. What a gift. Honestly. And it hurts to say it, and I can feel my tears welling up in my eyes, but seriously, I wish my mom wasn't going through what she was going through, but I'm so grateful to be there. So that she don't have to go through it by herself. She can go through it with with what she made. You made the thing that is meant to come here and make sure that you're all right in the midst of this process. I'm going to help you slide on up out of here. I'm going to help you transition. I'm going to make sure that there's comfort for you. The least I could do after teaching me how to be bold, how to be caring, how to be sensitive, how to cry, how to be a person whole and unfettered by the pressures of this life. Come on, the least I could do. That is prayer. Freedom. Space. Like, that's prayer. For sure.
Oh, that was a good one, Jason. Oh.
This is a good game.
We end our show the same way every time, with a trip in our memory time machine. You pick one moment from your past. It is not a moment you want to change anything about. Just a moment you want to linger in a little longer. Which moment do you choose?
Oh, my father, when I finally made it, started to make a couple of dollars, you know, I went and I bought myself a 911, a Porsche 911, cherry red, guard red, as the Porsche people say. Mm-hmm. And I took it to my father's house. My father had been fighting cancer for a while at this point. But he was home. He had done some surgeries. It was looking good. And I took it. He was a car man, specifically American Muscle. He loved the Mustang. He loved, a Corvette. You know, that those were his cars. And he did not like anything other than those cars. But I took my German sports car to his house. And he came outside and he sees this car. And his eyes light up and he's like, let me drive it. And he gets in the car and we pull out onto the main road. He lived in the country and we pushed it to about 150 miles an hour, maybe. And I remember him slowing the car down and I'm looking at him and I'm like, man, I'm white knuckling. And he's like,
yeah.
And we pull back into his driveway and he's like, I won't lie to you. I was a little afraid. Right. And we just bust out laughing. We had this moment. And then right after that, he told me that he was going to die. So right after that, he said, look, I'm not going to be able to beat this thing. And I probably got 6 weeks. And so I just want to, so we started to have a very different conversation and it was all very lovely, honestly, but painful, And if I could extend a moment, me and the old man we would have driven a lot longer. We would have taken a road trip. We would have just tore the road apart because it was the last time that I saw my father alive. He was living for another 6 weeks, but the last time I saw that thing in his eye that reminded me of who he was and what he had given me, this knucklehead kid who had a penchant for toys and, I'm just like him. Fast cars and all the things, all the stupid stuff of boyhood. I think about that often. This is after telling me that he had a fake Rolex. I always thought he had a real Rolex. And he's like, he set all these standards for me that I grew into this man who got all the better versions of the things he was pretending to have. And so I just wish he would have lived a little longer for me to give him and show him some of the sweet bits.
Jason Reynolds, his new original audiobook soundtrack is out now. Jason, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. So this might have been the best interview I've done, maybe ever.
And that's it for this week's Wild Card from NPR. I'm Rachel Martin. We'll shuffle the deck and be back next week. Same time, same place.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Next up on this NPR station, KQED, Peter Sagal and team will be off and quizzing with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. We do have news updates ahead as well from NPR News and Dana Cronin with KQED News. Good morning. Support for KQED comes from Heath Ceramics. Heath's Make Good Market returns to San Francisco this weekend. Visitors can explore dozens of craft vendors along with food trucks from off the grid. Heath Ceramics, handcrafted in the Bay Area since 1948. And Earth Justice, the nation's largest environmental law organization, with more than 200 full-time lawyers who fight for a healthy environment. Learn more about how to get involved at earthjustice.org. Earth Justice, because the earth needs a good lawyer. This week at KQED Food, food editor Luke Tsai reflects on his favorite meals of the year. From pork chops in an Oakland parking lot to Lao food inside a Castro Valley bowling